I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. As a boy, I absolutely loved Revell. Now, Revell is that plastic scale model manufacturing company. You may have heard about them. Think model airplane glue and molded plastic parts that a young kid like me might have assembled back in the 70s. A boy with an active imagination about what it would be like to fly a B-17 bomber or maybe launch a Hornet fighter jet off the deck of the USS Kitty Hawk aircraft carrier. I was that kid. But I gotta tell you, of all the model ships and rockets and airplanes I ever glued together, my all-time favorite was probably the PBY Catalina flying boat. That is an amphibious aircraft from the World War II era, and I was just enraptured with the notion that this was a flying boat, dual purpose. It could fly, but it was a boat too. And it could take off from land or water. It had pontoons out at the wingtips. And in case you're wondering, a plane with pontoons, that is just about the coolest thing in the whole world. And when you're about 12 years old, you're in the store looking at a box with a model in it. You're practically salivating over the dramatic painting of this vintage airplane in action, accelerating on the surface of some lake or bay, fighting against the drag of water to get airborne again, then slowly rising as water drips off the sides and underbelly of the plane. I would have paid any price for that model to take home and put together and play with, but I didn't have to pay that price. It just cost about $1.99 back then, and I took it home and put it together and loved it. Well, these planes must have been very useful military implements back in the day, but the PBY Catalinas aren't in use much by the military at all anymore. I would imagine the military has other options for amphibious devices, but if you want to see a seaplane or an amphibian, as they call it nowadays, if you want to see one of these in actions, chances are you would need to be near a wildfire. The old amphibians were once retrofitted to carry water, I understand, but they never really met the need very well. Apparently, what does meet the need nowadays is a plane nicknamed the Super Scooper. I want to introduce you to somebody who knows all about them, a person who flies them. In fact, he founded a company expressly to provide the service that these planes offer in fighting wildfires. Tim Sheehy is a former Navy SEAL, an Army Ranger, a Purple Heart recipient. He is CEO of Bridger Aerospace, headquartered in Bozeman, Montana, and he's on the line with us right now. Tim Sheehy, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me.
Tim, I'm a kid at heart. I loved model airplanes as a kid, but I never became a pilot. Now, here you are, a pilot. Did you ever make model airplanes as a kid?
Yes, Marcus, I absolutely had model airplanes as a child. In fact, I still do today. We have dozens of them here in our office at Bridger Aerospace. And it's a great learning and training tool for our staff to look at those and play with those. We have a model of each aircraft we use in our fleet. And it's always useful for awareness, marketing, education, and training for our staff. And my interest in model airplanes goes back to when I was a child as well, just like you. I had my first flight in a plane when I was 8 years old with my neighbor, who was a former Navy pilot. And he lived on the lake with us and had a float plane. So actually one of my very first flights was in a seaplane. And that cinched it for me that I knew aviation would be a part of my life going forward. And I actually soloed an airplane before I got my driver's license, and I've been a pilot ever since.
The thing that interests me the most here is that you actually started in a float plane. That's the kind of aircraft that you learned in?
It's not the aircraft I learned in, although there are a lot of folks, particularly in Canada, who – many have never flown a plane on wheels. They start flying float planes, and that's all they fly. For me, that was the first exposure I had to flying a plane. However, I then went and learned how to fly on a wheeled aircraft.
Now, you've said float plane. Is that the way to talk about these things? I said amphibious aircraft. Is that too highfalutin?
Actually, there's three different types, and they all mean something different. A float plane will refer to an aircraft that is a land aircraft with floats attached to it, so a Cessna or a Piper Cub with two pontoons on the bottom. And technically floats refer to straight floats is what people will call them, and that's just pontoons, no wheels attached to them. They can only take off and land on the water. A seaplane generally refers to a plane that is designed to be on the water, a plane like the CL-415, which you talked about, or the PBY Catalina, where the hull is actually a boat hull. So the fuselage of the airplane acts as both a fuselage and a boat hull. An amphibian can mean either of those, but an aircraft that also has wheels that extend out of its pontoons, its hull. So technically, three names for those aircraft. However, colloquially and actually officially, the FAA refers to all of them as seaplanes. You are a seaplane pilot if you're qualified to fly any one of those three categories.
Now, we're going to talk specifically about the Super Scooper and your story, too, your personal story a little bit more. But before we do, can you walk me through what would be a typical run for one of these planes while fighting a wildfire? We don't have to go through the flight check on all the details, but mm-hmm. but the juicy details of what makes this kind of a flight so unique.
Absolutely. And, of course, fire aviation in and of itself is a unique mission, a very small part of the industry, but a very impactful one. It's a mission that it's incredibly important to be able to go out there and save lives every day is very fulfilling, and it's probably the best job you can have in aviation. But when you talk about what a mission profile looks like for any firefighting aircraft, it's really, to simplify it, you're a fire engine in the sky. You'll be at the fire base, and you'll wait for the call. And sometimes it's a new fire where you'll be sitting there playing cards, reading a book, and the alarm will go off, and you need to launch to a new start, which is what we refer to them as. And sometimes you'll be assigned to a larger ongoing incident where that fire may be several thousand acres, and it's what's called a campaign incident, where you're going to spend several days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months, fighting a very large wildfire. Every day is going to be different. You're going to take off. You're going to fly low altitude. You're going to scoop a load of water, and you're going to fly right over treetop level and drop that water on the fire. An important distinction to understand about aerial wildfire fighting is there are many different tactics to attack a fire, but largely aircraft fall into two different categories, direct attack and indirect attack. And direct attack means you are attacking the flames directly. You're dropping water directly on the fire to put it out or cool it down or slow it down, whereas indirect attack is normally dropping retardant around the edges of the fire ahead of the fire spread in an attempt to build a fire break or a barrier to eventually slow down or stop that fire from going further. Super Scoopers are specifically designed for direct attack missions. One thing that's very unique about the Super Scoopers is simply their frequency of drops. Larger air tankers, which have a very important role in wildfire fighting, sometimes will get 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 drops in a day. They have to fly back to the airfield and get pumped full of retardant chemicals and then fly back to the fire. Super Scoopers can get upwards of 100 drops a day. We can put a much larger volume of water onto a fire incident because it takes us only 12 seconds to fill up our gallons when scooping out of water. We come across the water, land at about 91 knots, scoop the water, and 12 seconds our tanks are full, and we're very quickly off the water and back to the fire incident.
So this Super Scooper is hands down the most effective delivery system for the volume of water and the frequency of missions.
That would be a matter of opinion. Of course, every agency and every operator, I think, has their favorite platform. Clearly, I am biased. I fly and own these aircraft, and I believe heavily in their capability. I think the facts do speak for themselves that as far as the volume of water being able to get delivered on an incident every day, no asset can deliver as much volume of liquid onto an incident in a single daylight period as a Super Scooper can. And that really is just a fact. However, there are disagreements. Some agencies prefer retardant chemicals, which can slow the spread of a fire over fresh, clean water. And I think both strategies have validity, and in truth, they must be used together to get the best effectiveness on a fire incident. But a short answer to your question, in my opinion, is yes, that is the most effective platform. You're going to get the most bang for your buck for the amount of hours flying in a day. Our asset can deliver sometimes up to 150,000 gallons a day onto a fire, whereas traditional tanker assets may only be able to get 20 to 30,000 a day.
Now, I have heard that the devices that actually scoop the water up, that they're going to protrude down from under the belly of this thing, they're just about the size of a human hand. They're kind of small, I guess.
That's correct. The probes is what they're called, which are very small. If you cut both your hands together as if you're going to reach down and cup water out of a bowl to drink, are about the size of what each probe is. And there's two of those on the step of the aircraft, which is back towards the rear portion of the hull. And those two probes, you'll extend those as you're coming in to land on the water. And you'll scoop through those probes. And in 12 seconds, you'll have 1,500 gallons of water literally shoved by the force of the aircraft through those probes. And very quickly, you're loaded, and then you retract those probes to reduce the drag, and you're off the water on your way.
Yeah, you do this yourself. You're not just like the CEO watching from afar. In the summer, I understand you're out and about flying one of these.
I am. It's important to me. Again, in my old job, obviously, as a SEAL team leader, leading from the front is very important to me. They had to carry this risks. I was wounded overseas. I was in a fatal plane crash 2 years ago where I walked away and the other gentleman didn't, unfortunately. It's a high-risk job, but I can, in good conscience, ask my pilots to go out and take risks that I myself am not willing to take. So it's very important to me that I remain involved in flight operations. I don't fly as much as I'd like, of course, but it's enough that I have an understanding of the mission very, very intimately, and I understand the risks that my air crews take. And it's important for me to know that, to be an effective leader for them. It's also important for them to be able to see that, hey, the boss is out here risking his life with us as well. He's not just at home, you know, enjoying the big paycheck that we generate for what we're doing. It's also, to be honest, Mark, it's a lot of fun.
The fun part. Give me a percentage of why you do this. Is it 90% for the fun?
Honestly, I'd say 50% for the fun and 50% for the mission.
That's a pretty safe answer.
I love the mission, and I can promise you, I started this company in my barn with my co-founder, my wife, 6.5 years ago. Literally, it was the classic startup for us. You know, our savings from the military. My wife was a Marine, and we had our one-year-old child. We were actually living in a tent on our land here in Montana, and we had a passion for the mission that we were trying to complete, which was increase the capability of aerial surveillance to support first responders and warfighters, and that morphed into wildfire support. And, you know, several years later now, we're almost 300 people across our enterprise. We're very proud to be a Montana company, an American company, but the mission is so important, and our mission is very, very simple. It's to save lives. And whether that's through wildfire fighting with our Super Scooper aircraft or fire surveillance with our drones, we're trying to bring the absolute best techniques and technology to bear in support of America's citizens on the ground, because after all, this is a pernicious threat that every single year costs dozens, sometimes hundreds of lives. And it's very important that we're there.
So, Tim, imagine me as a kid with that Catalina aircraft model, and I'm going to be imagining the same thing. I'm just this kid with the model, and I'm trying to put it through its moves, and I'm bringing it down. I don't know. I may have filled the bathtub at some time to have this plane come down on the surface of the water. As I visualize what you do, I'm just thinking about the hazard of just coming into contact with water. Does it take a certain pilot skill to come down gingerly enough that you're not getting, you know, you're not smacking down on the water?
It absolutely does. And I'm far from the master of it, so I won't act as if I am, but I am capable of doing it. And flying in and of itself is, of course, part skill, part science, part art. Being a good pilot, having the intuition is important. And I think when you look at Super Scooper firefighting operations, one of the most interesting things about it is how many disciplines you're touching doing that. You have to be a good seaplane pilot, which is a skill in and of itself. You have to be a low-altitude mountain pilot, which is a skill in and of itself. Mountainous aviation is very hazardous. You have to be a fire pilot, which is also a skill in and of itself. So flying Super Scoopers on fires takes a lot of these skills, in addition to just general aviation capability, just being a pilot in and of itself, and combines them together into kind of this bundle of Superman skills that you really have to be able to be an effective pilot. And, of course, managing the water is one of those. Because just like carrier landings for the Navy, landing on the water is not a static, paved, fixed runway with numbers and paint and you know exactly where it is. It's moving. The sea state changes. There's currents. We may scoop out of rivers, which means we're going against currents. There's eddies in the rivers. You have to account for that. There are objects under the water that you may not be able to see, logs and rocks, especially out west where most of what we're scooping is reservoirs. On the bottom of a lot of these reservoirs are old towns, old mines, and there are objects under the water that you may not see. So there are so many other threats you have to consider when scooping water, especially in a fire environment where it's very chaotic. There's helicopters scooping nearby as well, or dipping, I should say, with their buckets. So And then, as you said, obviously you want to touch down gingerly enough where you are scooping the water, but you're not damaging the aircraft. So it's a fine dance of a lot of different skills you have to have. It takes a lot of practice and a lot of experience.
So would you ever dip down onto a body of water to scoop up water, not having done some research in advance to know what that reservoir might contain under the surface?
Ideally, no. Ideally, you've evaluated every potential scoop site, as we call them. There's the seaplane directory, which shows you a lot of the, not all, but most seaplane accessible bodies of water in the U.S. There's also other aircraft in fire, which we have about 20 aircraft, and they're called air attack, and they perform more of a C2 role, command and control role. Those aircraft will recon the fire area and look at a lot of different scoop sites before we'll show up and say, hey, you've got three or four different scoop sites. We've reconned them from above, and we think these are safe scoop sites. Ideally, any objects under the water will be called out in the charts, so you'll know about that. Sometimes the Forest Service and the DNR will send a boat out and clear the lake to make sure there's no other boats or jet skis or fishermen out there, which is also another big threat. But, of course, you can never be 100% certain of anything. So there's always a certain amount of risk there.
Now, it's all fine to talk about risk and think about the hazards involved, but there's investment in these things, too. These things are pricey. How big is your fleet and how much does a single plane cost?
Well, we have a fleet of about 20 aircraft, not all Super Scoopers. We have a lot of other type of aircraft as well. But speaking specifically about the Super Scoopers, depending on, you know, options and et cetera, normally they cost about $30 million a pop. And we currently own and operate four of them. We'll be getting an additional two from the factory in Calgary next year. And we may grow the fleet further after that.
Yeah, so you're not just, yeah, safety, you want to live, you want to survive this thing, but you're also the steward over a whole lot of money there. Do I dare ask you if these things have been damaged and repaired or even a single aircraft lost?
Well, for us, we haven't had any losses of Super Scoopers. Damage is part of the reality of what we do, of any aviation, but especially fire aviation. So we have a very robust maintenance organization. I think any aviation operation worth their salt has a very professional and robust maintenance operation. But yes, we do have damage. We do have wear and tear that has to be addressed. And you're absolutely right. There is the financial risk component to all this. And, of course, we model that into our models as far as financial planning and insurance and contracts, and we do our very best to mitigate. Of course, the most important thing is life and limb. We want to make sure our air crews are as safe as they possibly can be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I want to come back in just a moment and ask you about what it feels like. Is it ever a rush to feel that water drop out of the plane? I want to know what that feels like. Does it rumble? Does it purr? Does it hum? What kind of a sound does it make? We're going to talk more about this with you in just a moment here on Constant Wonder. Tim Sheehy is with us. He's the CEO of Bridger Aerospace, and we're talking about an airplane called a Super Scooper used in wild firefighting. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Tim Sheehy is with us. He is the CEO of Bridger Aerospace, and that company provides a service in fighting wildfires with its aircraft known as the Super Scooper. You may have seen video of this. If not, you really need to go. It's easy to find online. Just look for the Super Scooper and search that. The YouTube videos that I saw this morning even, and I've seen this many times in the past too, these aircraft coming down and skimming the surface of a body of water to scoop up 1,400 gallons of water to take back and drop on flames. Tim, you've been there, you've been piloting, you've dropped this. What happens at that moment? And after we talk about what it feels like, what the plane actually does, I want to know how hard it is to hit the target.
Well, all great points, Marcus. Obviously, hitting the target's the most important piece. And that all comes kind of old school style with you know, a little seat of your pants, Kentucky winded. You come in and you've got to spot it. There's really no advanced targeting computer. There's no infrared camera or auto drop system that tells you where to drop. I think there's been a lot of attempts to design that, but to this day, still the most accurate way to make these drops happen is feel, experience, and calling the drop either within the air crew or sometimes ground crews will do that in conjunction with you. But the feeling when you drop it is actually, you ask what it sounds like, it's a big thump. Because those doors drop open, and we have what's called a gravity-fed drop system, which is the best kind. Some drop systems in aircraft, particularly converted airliner-type aircraft, are pressurized systems, where if you imagine it, it's like one of those old Gatorade bottles, the green ones with the orange tops, where it's full of water, and you have to squeeze it to squirt the water out of a pressurized nozzle. You're getting sometimes a little bit of an uneven drop pattern. It's not as thick as it can be. Whereas imagine with ours, if you're holding a bucket of water, you just turn it upside down, it all falls out at once. So you get a much denser, more powerful drop out of a gravity-based system. So when our drop doors open, they drop open, and that water rushes right out of there, and there's a surge in the aircraft that jumps up in the air real quick because obviously you've just lost, you know, 5,000 plus pounds of weight of the aircraft. And then the doors close, and you're on your way back to the lake to get another scoop.
So as that aircraft lurches, I'm going to say, is it anything more than what I have experienced maybe in turbulence in a commercial jetliner flight?
Honestly, with a good air crew and all the air crews are good doing this mission, it's almost unnoticeable because you start to understand the correction. It's almost an imperceptible pushing forward on the control stick where you know when the drop's going to happen. As you press the drop button, you're already compensating for what that shift in attitude is going to be, and it becomes almost unnoticeable. If you didn't have a pilot that was ready for it or you didn't bother to correct, there would be a very noticeable nose-up attitude and jump in altitude. But with an air crew that knows, you'll feel nothing more than some very small turbulence that you'd be used to in an airliner.
And back to the accuracy point, my guess is that in order to hit that target, are you best served being as close as you dare go or maybe a little bit above that?
It depends on the fuel type, the terrain type, and the guidance from the air tactical group supervisor, who is the individual flying overhead, kind of dictating what's going to happen on that fire. If you're dropping into timber, which if we're fighting fires up here in Montana, Idaho, British Columbia type territory, you'll have 150, 200-foot fir trees, pine trees, where you're trying to get that load down to the bottom of the forest, because although the trees may be burning, you're trying to penetrate that canopy to get as much of your water down and into the source of the fire as you can. Whereas if you're flying on a grass fire out in California or a bush fire, perhaps in Utah or a scrub brush, that's a different fuel type where you might not have to get as close to it to penetrate it. You can be a little higher and get a wider drop pattern. So in answer to your question, being low is always a double-edged sword because you want to get as much impact on the target as you can, but you also have to weigh how much area you're going to cover. The lower you are, the denser and smaller your drop pattern will be. The higher you are, the wider and longer your drop pattern will be. So it's always going to be a trade-off, and that'll be a tactical decision made on site. As far as accuracy, there is a bollard on the front of the aircraft that is used to tie off if you're docking somewhere. It's a little it's about the size of kind of a soda can that you see right off the nose of the aircraft, and that really serves as your aiming point. And as soon as your drop point passes under that bollard, you're going to press drop, and that'll pretty much put you right on target.
You know, that sounds real scrappy. Like you just figured that out after a couple of runs. You said, "Oh, we figured it. Watch that bollard, right?"
Yeah, kind of.
Well, this is obviously a coordinated effort between the forces on the ground and the people in the air. And I'm going to ask a question, and you can take this where you want because it leads to a whole range of issues. But if I'm on the ground and I get hit by this water, is it going to knock me over?
Unfortunately, it won't knock you over. It'll probably kill you. That is probably the single most important inter-team safety control we have in wildfire aviation. Obviously, there's safety controls and numerous here, pre-flight checks and flight training and airspace deconfliction. We don't want to run planes into each other. But when it comes to air-ground coordination, the single most important piece is not dropping your load onto the ground crews. And there's a very simple command that you're going to hear before every drop, and that is line is clear, clear to drop. And that is a message from the ground commander who's in charge of that ground team to the air tactical group supervisor or the lead plane pilot, if there is one there, or directly to the tanker pilot and crew or scuba pilot and crew to inform them the line we've discussed for you to drop this time is clear. There are no vehicles or ground personnel in the drop line. You are clear to drop. And you will not drop until you hear those words from whoever is dictating that incident. And it brings into focus the reality of what our mission is, which is close air support, which is a military term, but it accurately describes what we do as firefighting. Ultimately, wildfire incidents are won and lost on the ground by the ground teams and the ground firefighters corralling these fires on the ground. Our job is to support their efforts so that we can slow the fire down, cool it down, or put it out enough that they can build the fire break to protect infrastructure and people from it spreading further. And therefore, the integration with the ground team is one of those skills I mentioned earlier that a firefighting crew has to have that a lot of other pilots don't have to have. Airline pilots don't need it. Charter pilots don't need it. But your ability to talk to someone on the ground, turn what they're asking for into a tactical reality, and make sure that you're supporting them, not interfering with them, is incredibly important. And I learned this lesson many times overseas, where sometimes aerial assets pushed out to support a ground unit can become a liability and a hindrance if they're not properly coordinated. They can fly overhead. I was actually wounded one time by a friendly missile strike that hit us. It was fired off target, and they fired at the wrong location and hit me and my team instead of the enemy location. And that's a great example of uncoordinated air assets that can be a greater threat than they can be a help. Therefore, that integration with the ground team and not dropping our water on those ground crews is the pinnacle of what we do.
Was that the Purple Heart story right there?
Actually, no, it's not. That was a separate incident, but the Purple Heart itself obviously is a medal that recognizes being wounded, but a lot of that comes down to paperwork too, and you know, who has time to write up everything that happens overseas but that was a separate incident.
Yeah, I do want to talk a little bit about Afghanistan in a bit, but I've got to go back to this without being too gruesome. Is it the speed of the water that would kill me if I were under a drop?
It's the weight and the speed. Yes, you know, the water coming out of the aircraft weighs, you know, almost 6,000 pounds, and it's coming down in a combined size, depending on how high we're dropping, you know, about the size of if you park two pickup trucks nose to tail in each other, that's about the size of the drop pattern that's hitting the ground. So imagine a 6,000 pound plate of steel that size coming down. You know, when the water's moving that fast, that's about what's hitting you.
Yeah, I mean, analogous here might be jumping off of a suspension bridge or something like that. You hit the water. It just depends. The water's coming at you either way. Yeah.
And the plane is flying at 115 knots normally when you're dropping that water, which is about 130 miles an hour, 140 miles an hour. And of course, it's also falling out of the sky. So between those two airspeeds, you've got a pretty fast moving mass of liquid there that's going to severely injure you. And unfortunately, two summers ago, I believe it was, there was a drop that did kill a firefighter that accidentally was dropped incorrectly. And tragically, a firefighter was killed. So it has happened. Unfortunately, it will probably happen again. But it's an unfortunate reality of the mission.
Now, I understand that I don't know if it's the vast majority, but a majority of these wildfires are in Canada. Is that right?
No, I don't think that's accurate. I think the aircraft, the Super Scoopers that we fly, are built in Canada and were designed for Canada. There's a long story there I'm happy to get into if you're interested, but I don't think the majority of the wildfires in North America are in Canada. But
I guess what I was asking is if the majority of the ones serviced by a plane dropping, because I'm thinking about all of the bodies of water in Canada compared to down the arid Intermountain West where I live. There are some lakes here, but not like Canada.
True, exactly. Canada has infinitely more bodies of water to scoop than North America. However, than the U.S. But I think one thing to remember is not all fires are fought. A lot of fires that are burning deep in the wilderness, which is what most of Canada is, which Alaska is, there's no basis to fight those fires. Oftentimes, they're allowed to burn and go uncontrolled because they're not threatening infrastructure, they're not threatening lives, and it's simply not cost effective to fight those incidents. So unless it's threatening a very sensitive wildlife refuge, or unless it's threatening infrastructure or people, normally those incidents are allowed to just burn themselves out.
So back to this Afghanistan question, the thought that I have is that you have had some skills and some philosophies, some worldviews that may have transferred from your experience in the military coming now to this work you do in support of fighting wildfires. Do you see a direct transfer? Do you see a direct link of and what is that common denominator that you feel that it's kind of like being back in Afghanistan maybe, or you're serving a similar cause, or the dangers, the risks, the hazards are similar?
I think to a certain extent, all of the above. I went in the military to serve. I didn't have any illusions about what I was getting into. I wanted to be of service to our nation, and that was really where my desire to join the military came from. And that's actually how I ended up in special operations. I went to the Naval Academy to be a pilot. Once I got there and the wars were getting underway in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and it became apparent that the real need for the military wasn't in pilots. They weren't short of jet pilots, and they didn't need jet pilots. They needed men on the ground to fight these wars. And it occurred to me that flying was a selfish desire for me. It wasn't really what the nation needed, and that's what led me into the ground side of the military. So I went into the SEALs and did several deployments in support of that. And in those lessons, always servant leadership was front of mind at all times in any sort of situation. And especially as an officer and a team leader, your team comes first, the mission comes first, and owning those outcomes is the most important thing. And to own those outcomes, you have to hold a standard and empower your team, and you have to serve your team, because you can't expect the outcomes that you desire if you're constraining your team with micromanagement or poor leadership or an unclear vision for what the mission is going to be. And ensuring that clarity of mission is present is the most important leadership principle for me, making sure that every member of the team, whether they're an accountant, whether they're a mechanic, whether a pilot, is very clear that our mission is to save lives. And the reason that's important is because I don't want them making decisions, the micro decisions that everyone has to make every day. They're not going to come ask me what they should do. But if they understand the vision and the mission and they understand what the priority of our enterprise is, every little decision they make will support that mission. And they can't do that, though, if it's not clear. And that was really a realization I had when fighting an insurgency in Afghanistan, where an insurgency is inherently an organic, decentralized threat. We're not fighting the Nazis. We're not fighting the Japanese, where there's a coordinated command and control structure that's going to surrender when a certain amount of geopolitical strain is reached, et cetera, et cetera. You're dealing with a completely organic, disaggregated adversary that is constantly innovating, constantly changing. And if you try to face off against an adversary that acts like a gaseous material and you're trying to beat it with a baseball bat, you're going to fail. So you have to share, you have to adapt to that threat by yourself being organic and decentralized and constantly evolving. And that's the only way you can effectively counter a threat like that. Taking those same lessons to business has been important. And that's built a great team and make them understand the mission and the vision and then support them unconditionally to achieve success in that mission. But the lessons learned in leadership, the lessons learned specifically in obviously getting more tactical here and air-ground coordination was really what led me after I was medically separated to found my company, to say that there is a need for a better air-ground interaction for missions outside the military, public safety missions. And that eventually led us into wildfire. And applying those lessons, I believe, is what's made us very successful very quickly as a small business.
I want to conclude here, Tim, going back to just the aircraft itself. A little factoid that I heard was that these super scoopers are about the size of a Boeing 737. They're very large aircraft. Isn't that so?
They are, yes. They're not quite the size of a 737, but yes, they're in that league. If you've seen a C-130 or a large, cargo plane of that kind, they're in that league. You know, they got about a 100-foot wingspan and 32-foot tall tail. They're big aircraft.
Yeah.
So, and they have to be big to be able to carry the loads that they're scooping.
And last of all, this is going to sound kind of silly, But who picked the color for those things? There's striking paint job on them.
Well, oddly enough, I designed that paint job myself, many revisions over many months. But I spent a lot of time with a pencil and papers and sketching and PowerPoints and cutting and pasting color wheels and everything else. And it's a bold paint scheme, to be sure. But I think it very clearly states our mission. And again, everything in the company has to support the mission. And there's no question when that plane flies by that it's there to fight fire. And that's why it's painted that way.
Yeah, there is what is a bright, kind of a yellowish orange color is predominates, and it does look like an emergency kind of function there. Like, you know, we paint bright colors on fire engines too.
Exactly, and big letters. It's a yellow base with a fire engine red accent, and then along the side in big red letters is fire, and on top of the wings is fire. So it's no question that if a boater's on the lake and we fly low overhead, they know what we're there to do.
Tim, this has just been enjoyable for me, and I just wish you all the best and your crew, and continue fighting those fires safely. Take care, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Marcus.
Tim Sheehy with us. He is CEO with Bridger Aerospace, and he and his teams fly in support of fighting wildfires. They fly that plane called a Super Scooper, and I really do recommend check it out sometime on YouTube. It's hard to run a firefighting business without fires. So in one sense, good news for Tim Sheehy is bad news for folks on the ground. And there's been a lot of bad fire news lately. Are mega fires on the rise? We'll find out when we return to Constant Wonder. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. Is it true then that wildfires are on the rise worldwide? To find out, I spoke with Ben Abbott, a plant and wildlife sciences professor at Brigham Young University. Megafires, a new breed of wildfire. We don't quite understand them totally yet. And Abbott addresses the issue first on the question of what is causing megafires, which apparently has something to do with growing pollution in the form of two key plant nutrients that are basically creating way too much fuel out there.
That's exactly right, Marcus. These nutrients aren't toxic on their own. They're things that all life needs. The two most common nutrients are nitrogen and phosphorus. And most of you have probably seen that on a bag of fertilizer you get from the hardware store. That's the N and the P that's in the fertilizer you put in your garden. The problem is how much, and then also what time of year it ends up in these water bodies. That's what can really create these issues.
Well, I go way back in my memory to when I was a kid, and we always had National Geographic magazines in our home. And I remember the Yellowstone fires and the cover and the pictures of those fires. And the story there was, at first, it was one of fear and tragedy and dismay and sorrow. And then as the years went on, the story became one of regeneration of you know, it was kind of a rejuvenating thing for parts of yeah. Yellowstone. And so somewhere in here, there's a story that could have a happy ending, maybe.
Absolutely. I think that in general, we tend to have a much too negative view of wildfires. Wildfires play a crucial role in these ecosystems. Humans tend to like things to stay the same. Right? We want to build houses and roads and walk along the same trails always. Nature, on the other hand, is constantly dynamic. It's constantly changing. And when we try to freeze nature in place, that actually can have some really negative consequences. So if you look back over the past couple hundred years in the western United States, we have suppressed wildfires. And even up to this day, we're running what's called a wildfire deficit. We're not having as many as we would without suppression of wildfires. That can cause all kinds of ecological problems, accumulation of excess material. It also can disadvantage some vegetation and animal species that are adapted to take advantage of those wildfires, things like aspen and a whole bunch of wildfires and grasses that won't survive in a fully developed mature forest. They need those openings when there is a wildfire.
Well, you're going to have to help me out with the idea of smoke getting in the air, because I always think of that as a bad thing. And if we've disrupted some of these cycles, you know, the pictures this last year out of San Francisco of they were hellish pictures of the sky over the Golden Gate Bridge being more golden than the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah. And that's where the story really gets complicated. And it's important to remember, had we all along been allowing wildfires to burn, that would be one thing. We haven't. We suppressed them for a long period of time. But over the past 50 years or so, our management of fires has vastly improved. And now what we're seeing is a large increase in the extent and severity of wildfires that's not associated with direct human management. It's being driven by climate change. Higher temperatures, drier fuels, and longer seasons when things are ready to burn. And so this you can't just naively say wildfires are good or bad, because now we're seeing the fires in California, Oregon, more recently in Colorado. Right, they've had the largest and the second largest wildfires in their history this year. And those are clearly associated with climate change. We have very careful scientific studies that have been done over the past few years that show that the majority of that increase in wildfire area and severity is attributable to human-caused climate change.
I would imagine it's very difficult to come up with any kind of an estimation about how much of this is to be pinned on us humans for the way we managed forests versus how much of this is to be pinned on us humans for the way we've pumped carbon into the atmosphere. But can it be measured? Can you really say, well, this is like 90% about climate change and only 10% about doing controlled burns? I don't even know how you could.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what the utility would be of demonstrating it that precisely.
You know, I think it's actually very important. We call that the science of attribution in climate change and environmental science. So what caused that event? And it's really pertinent, because if it's all about management, then we need to take certain actions to improve the way that the Forest Service and other land management groups are interacting with these ecosystems. But if it's climate change, we need to address that at its source, which is mainly the production of greenhouse gases. So Mike Flanagan is one of the leaders in attribution science. He's at University of Alberta, and he published a paper just this year about the California wildfires. And they came up with a number, and there's always an uncertainty range around that number. You know, it's going to be plus or minus 20 or 30%. But what they found was that 45% of the wildfires this year were directly attributable to climate change. And that matches other work that's come out over the past few years that shows that since 1985, when we first had these high-frequency, high-resolution wildfire measurements, there's been a doubling in the annual extent of area burned. And that doubling is attributable to climate change almost exclusively. That's after we've accounted for the changes in management over that period. And maybe more disturbing is the fact that the severe wildfires, the area of severe burn where you've consumed most of the organic matter in the soil and the material in the canopy, that has increased eightfold over the same time period. So we really are living in this unprecedented time of highly severe and very large wildfires.
So as long as we're talking attribution here, I think it might be good to even just talk about, is there a percentage of these that would have happened if there had been no humans present?
Absolutely. Wildfire occurs naturally. The mega fire that I believe you were referring to earlier here in Utah Valley that affected Utah Lake, that was started by a lightning strike. So the lightning strike, of course, wasn't caused directly by humans. What we did was we kind of set the scene by drying the fuels out, and then that wildfire burned all the way into October, a time period when usually here in Utah we're starting to get cooler temperatures and rain that's coming in. But that wasn't the case in 2018. So that's a pattern that we're seeing all over the place. Again, it's not that all wildfires are negative. They're a crucial part of the ecosystem. But if they're happening at the wrong times, and if they're too severe and large, then they can be very destructive, not only to humans, the air that we breathe, but also to the organisms in the ecosystems.
Now, I don't know how many times I've already used the word megafire, but sometimes, you know, mega mega just gets tossed out there sometimes as a superlative. But I think there's something else going on here. Has somebody actually defined what qualifies as a megafire and what's just a forest fire?
Yeah, so mega is defined typically based on two factors: the size, over 100,000 hectares, and the severity. It has to be moderate or severe severity. And so there also can be gigafires. So thinking about the storage in your computer, you've got a megabyte and then a gigabyte, a thousandfold larger than that. And so we now saw this year the very first gigafires, when a few of those very large fires in Northern California merged and created a gigafire.
So you go mega, then giga, then apaca fire.
Yeah. Or is it terra after giga?
I'm not sure.
My prefix is in order. But it does have a formal definition. But for me, there's nothing magical that happens right when it goes over that threshold. What's different is just how large and how severe these wildfires are.
Now, I know that you have a lot to do with the study of just the cycles of water. So are you actually tracing what gets washed away from off of, say, a mountainside down into a stream?
Yeah, just like you said, my specialty is mainly on the aquatic side. So the streams, the groundwater, the lakes that are receiving water from these different environments. And what's really interesting about a wildfire is, because it removes so much vegetation, that vegetation typically takes water up from the soil and returns it to the atmosphere. Once that's gone, a lot more water, at least in the first year after the wildfire, typically runs off. And with that water comes a huge amount of sediment and nutrients. Those nutrients also would have been greedily taken up by the plants that were growing. You know, they are nutrient limited. It's not like a plant in your garden where they have as much nutrient as they could want. They are trying to scour every molecule of nitrogen and phosphorus from that soil. So once they get taken out of the picture, that nitrogen and phosphorus can be leached out of the soil into the water. And so that's what we've seen in the year or two, up to 5 years after the wildfire. We see these releases of nutrients and then other materials that come out of the wildfire.
Is this going to differ from region to region? I mean, I'm thinking about a sagebrush area in the Intermountain West versus a redwood fire in Northern California, and the way the roots are trying to capture nutrients. I would imagine that the scarcity or the abundance of nutrients is, you got deserts and you have more fertile areas, right?
Absolutely. You've touched on a really important thing, that the type of ecosystem is going to determine what the response is, and also the severity of the wildfire. So in those sagebrush ecosystems, sagebrush is a really neat fire-adapted species. It can survive moderate severity fires really well. But these high severity fires can kill the sagebrush. And you can imagine, if the plants are still there the year after the wildfire, they're going to hold the soil in place. They're going to retain some of those nutrients. So the wildfire might not have much of an effect on water quality. But if you have a high severity wildfire, especially if that affects a large area, then not only can you have release of nutrients, you also can have these massive landslides and debris flows that happen afterwards. So the type of ecosystem matters, and also how severe is the fire.
When you say severe, you're talking about how hot it gets for how long, or what are you talking about exactly?
There are two ways that severity is measured, and one of them is that exactly. How hot did the flame actually get? But the ecosystem way of measuring fire severity is, what percentage of the material, the burnable material, was consumed. So if you've ever walked by a wildfire, sometimes it looks like a moonscape. Anything that was alive is gone. It's been vaporized, combusted. Other times, there still are tree trunks that are there, sometimes living plants. You still can have organic material in the soil. So that's going to be how we determine what the severity of the wildfire was for a particular area.
So I am by nature somebody who is given to a little bit of pessimism, I would have to say. And so when I see a megafire and I see a story of something out of California, I mean, I was thinking just the other day, I ought to take my kids on a little hike out to one of these areas that's been burned here locally, just so we can kind of see it and talk about it. And I think that would be instructive and educational, and I'm not sure that they're going to like it very much, because it might look a little like a moonscape. But what would I be looking for, just as somebody who's not a scientist, and I'm wondering, will that sagebrush return, or will that oak tree come back?
Yeah, there's some really important factors that determine what is the trajectory, what's the pathway of ecosystem recovery. In ecology, we call that succession. It's the stages that an ecosystem follows after some big disturbance. And it's really important what kind of seeds are left over. A very severe wildfire might burn down into the soil and destroy some of the seed bank. Those are the seeds that may have been there for sometimes hundreds or even thousands of years, waiting for the conditions to be right to germinate. If, however, there are native seeds left over in that area, very quickly you see some of these plants germinate and take advantage of that burst of nutrients and light that comes after the wildfire. But that also highlights one of the risks that we're seeing more and more. When we travel to places, very often we transport seeds unknowingly. They're stuck in our socks or the bottoms of our shoes. And sometimes we transport seeds that are not native. And there's certain non-native plants that can take advantage of those conditions really well. So here in the western United States, there's a species of grass called cheatgrass that spreads very, very easily. It grows very quickly. And if that takes over an area that was burned, that can be really damaging. And the ecosystem doesn't recover to what it was before. It could transition into to something new that doesn't have the biodiversity that it used to have.
So if an area has been burned, whether it's here in Utah or in Oregon or Washington or California, wherever it is, Colorado we've been talking about too, is our understanding of the succession of an ecosystem, are we far enough along that we kind of know what we could properly introduce if seeds could be brought in?
That's a great question. I actually would say that it still is an open question. Ecosystems are incredibly complex. They don't just involve the species that are there, but also the conditions that follow, the weather conditions, the soil conditions. And so a lot of it depends on what happens in the few years after that wildfire. And so we used to think 50 and 100 years ago that ecosystems followed this really orderly progression and that we'd be able to predict what would happen based on those initial conditions. Now we're much more humble intellectually as ecologists, and we recognize that it depends a lot on what the local conditions are. That said, there are certain actions that very often are taken. Native seeds often are redistributed to prevent soil erosion. And then sometimes people are asked to stay out of burned areas because they can be sensitive during that year or two after the wildfire occurs. So I'd encourage you to get informed and contact the local land managers or owners and get an idea of what they are trying to do to mitigate the effects of that wildfire.
Ben Abbott is a professor of plant and wildlife sciences at Brigham Young University. New technologies often throw somebody out of work. One historical case in point was the advent of the printing press. 15th century frustrations for one of Italy's greatest handmade book dealers. That story coming up when Constant Wonder returns after the news.